Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. As regular listeners know, these Soapbox podcasts are wholly sponsored. That means everyone you hear in a Soapbox podcast edition paid to be here. But that's okay, because we managed to book very interesting guests into these things, like today's guest, Sammy Lane. Officially, he's Okta's Director of Technology Strategy, but informally, he describes his role as being more like the Principal Security Architect at Okta. Now, Okta is a massive company these days. They are an identity provider, an IDP, and I confess to kind of not really paying enough attention to the rise of these cloud IDPs over the last 5+ years, right? I mean, they've been around a while now, I guess, but I always thought this stuff was a bit of a snooze fest. Well, flash forward a few years and now, you know, cloud IDP is everywhere and is actually responsible for some meaningful security gains. And the money, wow. Okta is a $25 billion company in US dollars. Now, to put that in perspective, the Symantec enterprise sale to Broadcom was worth $10 billion. And yeah, Sammy says he was kind of the same as me for a while. Like, you know, this stuff is a little bit dry. But then he wound up actually working at Okta and sort of went, okay, this stuff is really important. So yeah, Sammy joined me for this long conversation all about where the IDP space is at, and he started off by making the case that identity really is the new perimeter. It sounds like a cute catchphrase, but he makes a pretty compelling argument. Here's Sammy Lane.
If you look at an average company these days, they used to rack and stack their stuff in a colo or data center and deploy software on there. The users were inside the perimeter. You look at today, even in large enterprise, vast majority of the actual work is being done on systems that are not under your direct control, outside your premise, from devices that you don't control, that you may or may not have endpoint security on, that may or may not be managed by you. And the one unifying thing that you have left is the auth in and auth see into all of those systems, applications, processes, you know, that your team's using. So in that sense, you could make an argument that identity is the last perimeter that we truly have left, in that that identity event, when you're making an identity determination, are you who you say you are, and then make an authorization of you to do what you want to do in the app that you wish to use, that's your remaining perimeter. And as such, that's the richest and easiest target for people. And in our security conference disclosure, we had a great talk where the argument was made that it's the users of the systems, whether they are developer or the actual end user, that are the weakest link, the easiest target. Easier to target an individual than it is to target a heavily guarded production system. And that's kind of like where I'm seeing that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point to the shift to cloud, essentially, as being what makes this sort of more important. Like when everything was internal, it was less important because, you know, it could be a bit of a mess and it didn't really matter. I mean, you could still have issues there, right, around things like VPNs and, you know, anything accessing in, but I get what you mean.
No doubt. And but if you think about it, I mean, I think that the industry has also seen it, in that identity used to be something that you relegated to the B team that was worrying about the AD server somewhere in the basement, whereas the security group, you know, guys were on the seventh floor, right?
Yeah.
And now that's kind of shifted too. Identity is more viewed as a critical element. And if you look at like how the analysts who are tracking this are framing, say, for example, the move to zero trust, network is no longer the root of all trust, but instead you're looking at the individual whose identity is used to on a device to access over networks, systems that process that data, and then all of the things that are around it. So it's shifted the picture a little bit, and it's brought the authentication authorization more to the forefront than it ever was before. And it's also, it's really a great lever, because if you think about like the role of IDPs, it was boring. When I came to Okta like 4 years ago, I was not expecting that, because I had been on a vendor land side in security kind of companies my whole career. But I came to realize very quickly that that identity authentication authorization that actually can have huge security outcomes. It's what you can do with that. And I mean, that was the eye opener for me when I went to have my first conversations, with the Okta team. And I came to realize that where I had been, I was before this in cloud workload security, and before that in like fraud and risk intelligence. And all of a sudden I'm seeing that, hey, if I think about like the traditional tooling that I had been focused on and selling, et cetera, even if you think about like DevOps, with DevOps, traditionally, you're thinking about like, okay, what is your CI/CD pipeline look like? What is the tooling that you put in there? How do you secure your servers? How do you make sure that your patches, et cetera, are current? But at the same time, if you think it's like an attacker, how do you attack that easiest? Is you want them executing your code. So if you can log in as a DevOps engineer to a system or somehow compromise, the Jenkins server and have it orchestrate changes on your behalf, that's the keys to the kingdom again. And that's where I realized that, you can do a lot of security-related goodness by just attacking that user's identity and the device's identities that as they're coming in. And that really piqued my interest. That's changed the conversation from like, yeah, hey, I'm not interested, to going like, well, you know what, this could be really fun to, to work in this space.
So how is it fun though, right? Because the general perception is essentially it's like web AD, right? It's web AD. User goes in, there you go, off it goes. It's all, that's done. It's basically just a web directory. What's your description?
Certainly less sexy, than saying the new hotness, AI give me the hotness.
So that's what I'm saying, like sell the sexiness here. Give me the sexy description of what Okta does, right?
It is sexy only if you're interested in like the details, right? Because if you think about like the big picture, what could be less sexy than say lifecycle management?
Yeah.
Okay. User joins an organization. They change roles in an organization. They leave the organization. It's IT cost savings, and I'm already asleep.
Yeah.
But if you think about those same exact events from the perspective of like, how do you provision access to a production box to an engineer? Traditionally, it's been like, we'll just mint some certificates and then orchestrate them onto the prod system. Now, when that engineer then rage quits, now you're in a race against time. You're racing against clock to delete all of those keys from all those prod systems, hoping that your automation, figured out where they all are before they misuse them or something like that.
But this is the pre-web user provisioning sales pitch, right? Because that was like, that's a pitch that's been around for 20 years.
I know. And that's the crazy part, because if you think about that now in this context, the identity events of like joiners, movers, leavers become critical security controls. It's like, avoiding all those orphan accounts, making sure that you're not doing basically key-based access where keys have inherent privileges baked into them.
Yeah.
And instead now every access to every system is done based on the identity. And if the source of truth for that is your HR system, the moment you're terminated, you no longer have production access, as opposed to trusting that your script collected all the keys from the servers and you didn't forget anything, or that the engineer didn't bake their own access in that you didn't catch somehow in your sweeps.
It's amazing how much
things that change the game.
It's amazing how much progress we've made by just doing simple things that should have been done from word dot, right? Like the idea that you would have highly privileged accounts in Active Directory that weren't touched for months, and that wouldn't actually, administrators wouldn't get an alert saying, hey, you sure this account should exist, right? So these orphaned accounts, orphaned accounts never really should have been allowed to be a thing.
And they never should have been a problem, but it's so painful to do that. And then all the processes that people usually put around that are more focused on compliance than security. And I don't know if we want to open up that can of worms, but, that's like being a personal pet peeve of mine, that a lot of the things that we are doing are done so that you satisfy the letter of a regulation or an audit control that have really sometimes little to do with the actual impact that it has on the security of the system and can it be compromised and what the vectors would be.
Oh, look, I mean, that's, there's so many people listening to this fist pumping right there because, often compliance is like, it's a form of security theater, essentially. A lot of it, not all of it. And, this is an interesting thing, though, because like some of the newer NIST standards that are being phased in over the next few years, like they've got different levels. And you look at the higher levels of those standards and they're actually kind of good, right? But that's different. That's for like really heavily regulated industries and stuff. But I guess what I'm saying is I feel like compliance is actually changing and might wind up somewhere useful in a few years.
Yes, absolutely. But what we've seen there is then, what are you actually using as the tooling to do that? A lot of the processes and tools that you used to put in place to meet those obligations. But like, think about that silly example that I gave of lifecycle management, joiners, movers, leavers. Do you have an account? Do you not have an account? If you think about the tooling that you had for like access and attestating on whether you should have access, a lot of those processes are really heavy today. I'm not saying that we're solving everything in one go, but if you look at the traditional tooling that's been in place for that, it's been really focused on making that kind of like an auditable process for attesting the need for somebody's access. And it was heavy, and you could only put a few things in scope because it was too expensive to implement everywhere. I think there's still a huge like gray space or a white space, if you will, that we could do better in. And I feel like if you think about the access of anything, it is who is accessing. There's always an actor of some kind, whether it's a genuine end user or an employee or an engineer or whatever, the privileged user, or a malicious, you know, person. There's an actor. Then there's a device that you use to access it. And if you look at the controls that you put in place, in the old world, you could think about your network edge as the control. But if you look at modern enterprise, they have literally hundreds of applications that are outside of that. You're not certainly consuming all those logs in your SIM and UBA tools from every single vendor that some marketing team somewhere signed up for. That ain't happening. Mm. But if you make it easy for the organization to participate in their own rescue and simply say, let's make sure that all of this access comes in through a single sign-on, simple IT cost-saving step from 10 years ago, right? But it gives you a single security control. All of a sudden, we're at the heart of those security controls where you can now apply then a consistent policy. You can apply modern multi-factor authentication where it would have been extremely difficult to
try to do it piecemeal across. Yeah, exactly, right?
And impossible.
And that's the thing. It's not even about cost saving at this point. It's like there's just no other way to do it, right? It's interesting that you mentioned UBA, right? Because I remember like years ago being an advocate. There's a friend of mine in Australia who's a pen tester who actually did deploy a couple of products, right? Which is unusual for a pen testing firm. But there was one that he liked, which was the Rapid7 UBA product, which was kind of an early UBA product, which was pretty good. It was kind of ahead of its time, and it was designed to deal with a lot of the stuff that would pop up on traditional Windows domains that if you were actually doing UBA, you could spot like abusive service accounts and things like that, right? And so that was a way that he found. He's like, look, if you run this software, it's actually going to get you somewhere, right? Which is somewhere quite easily, right? So that's why he was a big proponent of that product. I think it's been folded in and changed a dozen more times since then. I don't even know that it's a particularly, you know, good product these days. But my point is UBA, especially on Windows networks, was something that, you know, it actually did get you somewhere. Now, when you move to a cloud IDP model, right, and you've got a multi-billion dollar company like Okta behind you, I mean, the UBA opportunities for Okta just have to be massive. I mean, that's got to be an area that you work on quite a lot, right?
Yeah, I'm not here to make any product announcements, but we currently don't have a product in that space, but it's obviously an adjacency that's very interesting to us. We do have a lot of partners that we work with who do exactly that. Even in traditional networks, like if you look at Windows networks, there are a lot of companies that are specializing in that then tied directly into, you know, the Okta as the identity provider and kind of like the security policy enforcer using the MFA tools for authentication around those events, et cetera, and then capturing all of that into consistent logging. So we're doing things around that already through partners. But yeah, it's an obvious adjacency that's very interesting. And for us, it's like if you look at the opportunity to do things with the actual data, that's really an interesting aspect as well. Because if you have a SOC, even if you're like building a SOCless architecture in the future, you have data streams that you're trying to automate things off of, right? If you're going with the Netflix SOCless model. And one of the most important pieces of data that our customers are seeing there is the data that comes from those identity events. Because when a user logs into, you know, whether it's Salesforce or Slack or Zoom or whatever app it is, the event when that authentication authorization happens has a lot of rich data associated with it when it comes from logging of a system like what Okta has, because we're seeing the end user's device. It's redirected to us. We can look at the device fingerprinting. We can look at the
But I mean, doesn't this fall into the category mm-hmm. of UBA? I mean, because this is what I would call UBA, right?
Yeah.
And you already have this. It's just funny when you say, oh, yes. We're thinking about that. I mean, okay, so there's the fancy machine learning stuff, right? And then there's the, this person is logged in from two different devices in two different countries at once, right?
For obvious reasons, that's pragmatic UBA. I don't want to call it UBA because, you know, we're defining the term as being more than what we are already
doing. Yeah, so it's more about the behavior. Yeah, I get what you're saying, but like UBA when it started really was that. It wasn't about, you know, machine learning pixie dust. It was just about like these two things don't make sense. These two events don't make sense.
I'll let you call us UBA then because, you know, that's exactly what we do, which is like, is this normal for you? Is this behavior normal for you?
Yes.
And the challenge there is that UBA... really for it to be useful. I mean, this goes back to the zero trust maturity as well, because
I just want to stop you there. Like what's your definition of UBA then? If it goes beyond that, like what's your definition?
One of the biggest challenges is that any company that is an identity provider at heart, like Okta was, is that we tend to see things at the time of the user logging in. So you come in, we get an impression of, you know, your device, your network, you know, do you appear to be who you claim you are? We authenticate you, we MFA you with modern MFA tools of choice, whether it's WebAuthn or, you know, some kind of a push experience, and then we're done. We pass you down to the service provider. And there's a big challenge there today, which is these protocols that we're relying on, like OIDC.
Okay. So you're saying UBA is looking at beyond the authentication event and more into the user behavior.
It's the whole life cycle.
If you
go like, you know, if you buy the premise of zero trust, you know, then you need to really look at it, you know, continuously.
And that makes sense. Yeah.
And unless you're willing to put in a proxy in place, or all the downstream SPs have really good introspection APIs you can leverage to see their behavior within the system post authentication authorization. You've given them their access token, they're gone from your perspective as an IDP. Unless we do something interesting there, then, you know, I wouldn't call it purely UBA. We do UBA for identity and authentication.
It makes sense, but I think UBA, you know, for a long time, it was really just looking at authentication events, right, when it started. So
it sure was.
Yeah.
And the promise was that it does more, but I mean, we all know how hard that is. I mean, you mentioned those rapid 7 days, you know, when they first introduced it. I have a friend of mine who worked at an unnamed UBA company, and it was great, and it really worked. But in production, you basically needed a data scientist deployed at customer site managing the system 24/7 for it to remain effective. So it was unscalable, and they ended up folding and selling it in a fire sale. So those things are hard. And it's easy to say the marketing pixie dust, you know, words of ML and AI, etc. But it's more difficult to do it at a way that is A, truly automatable, and B, something that you can deploy against all kinds of environments at scale. And we're working on kind of like figuring out how to solve for both of those two.
So look, one thing, you know, we live in eternal hope that people are going to start abandoning, you know, Windows Active Directory and move more towards these more, you know, the modern IDP approaches. Now, obviously, you know, Okta integrates with Windows AD, but are you still seeing people spinning up a lot of Windows AD in this year, 2020?
Actually, we do, because, I mean, if you look at us, you know, everybody always thinks that, hey, Okta started from cloud-based SSO. But if you look at us, you know, majority of our customers have a bunch of Windows domains. Sometimes they have so many forests you can't see the individual, you know, domains, right? And we're basically handling the syncing into all of that. Mm. And what we're seeing is that, yes, there's still local stuff happening and being deployed, but people are getting smarter about it. Instead of basically saying, hey, if there's a username and password, we'll just stick it in AD, they're using AD for things that it's really good for. Like, for example, if you have Windows fleets that aren't all going to the most modern stuff, you're going to need GPOs. You're going to need to affect policies on those machines, et cetera. So use the AD for what it's good for, but it no longer is the center of the universe. Instead, the true source of the identity often becomes the HR system. And then the Okta is the glue that then replicates and pushes all of those either in real time JIT or synchronizes the information downstream to them. So often the direction has reversed from AD up to, you know, cloud down.
I'm seeing some interesting moves there too, in terms of like, I don't know how much longer group policy is going to be relevant, given that there's some companies now, startups, like sort of mid-stage startups, that are doing some really interesting stuff around endpoint management, and it's all cloud-based, right? And it all integrates with stuff like Okta, and you just think you can take this Windows stuff and set it on fire. And it all enables this zero trust model, which of course, you know, we can't do this interview without talking about zero trust. I mean, what started off as deperimeterization back in the day is now zero trust, and everyone says that they do it. It means different things to different people. But, you know, identity is a key part of however you define zero trust, identity is a key part, right? And 2020 in the pandemic, I mean, it's been the best thing that could have happened for zero trust. You know, I know that's an outrageously glass half full thing to say, given that it's a horrible situation for a lot of our listeners, but it's been good for zero trust.
Yeah, it has, arguably. Well, I have a local government here in the San Francisco Bay Area where I'm based, government agency that has a lot of, like, you know, critical workers, you know, for the pandemic, healthcare, you know, like county health, you know, people. This particular county had a zero trust plan that was basically a 24-month roadmap to move to a zero trust model from VPN perimeter for all of their worker access to their systems that they need for their daily work. And when the pandemic hit, they hit the reset button and implemented everything in less than 4 weeks, and took away the need for the traditional, you know, perimeter tools for VPNing in, et cetera, and went fully perimeterless. And of course, you know, being a county, they do not have a lot of money, as you can imagine, county governments wouldn't have. So you don't have to have tremendous resources, you know. Of course, big companies do the same. FedEx hit the same kind of reset button, and they basically went live in 36 hours, you know, across like 5-6 major platforms globally across their whole employee base. And that was also probably initially going to be like a 2-year process. So the pandemic certainly hit everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's great right that you've given us a couple of examples of the companies who've done it right, but plenty of them just went the other way and just said, VPN everything, everyone just get on the network, it's fine. You know, or RDP or whatever. Like, there were some.
Yeah, it was the unrequested, you know, stress test on what the true capacity of your VPN is and what your licensing allows you to do. People found out, you know, that Monday morning when the stay at home orders came into place.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I'm curious too, because you would have seen this. I mean, one of the things that we started talking about a lot when this whole thing kicked off is, like, you know, it's not going to be feasible for everyone to move to the cloud. So there's those sort of identity aware application proxies that, you know, integrate with services like Okta and allow you to take some of those on-prem applications and expose them to the outside world. They apparently work pretty well for web-based stuff, but anything non-web-based is, like, you know, the salespeople say, oh, no, it works great. But apparently, you know, people I know who've tried to implement it say, well, it's, you know, it's a little bit brittle.
Yeah. If you have a, you know, purely like thick client-based applications, it can be very, very, you know, difficult to basically go and say, just modernize that all at once. Mm. And we've seen different approaches. I mean, sometimes it depends a little bit, like our own Access Gateway, which is like a virtual appliance that you can deploy on your own network.
Oh, so you've got one as well, right? So this is essentially, because Cloudflare has one, Akamai has one, you've got one as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one that we have, you know, of course, you can go with any of those partners that you mentioned and do, you know, like Cloud Edge based. But sometimes we have customers who just want things that they can actually control and deploy either in their virtual, you know, infrastructure at AWS or in their physical infrastructure at their own colo or on-prem as a virtual appliance. And sometimes those are using trickier things like certificate-based authentication or, you know, and not just Kerberos or, you know, header-based auth. But with something like the Access Gateway, you can sometimes solve for that one as well. Not always. And if you have like this, you know, thick legacy applications where the client is a thick client application and there's no web way of doing things right, then it becomes really tricky. And maybe the solution for that is, you know, Citrix and other, you know, I don't know. I'm not prescribing that to anyone, but I'm just saying what I'm seeing.
Well, yes. And that's kind of what I was getting at by, like, yes, it was great that you could talk about some of the people doing it the right way, but there's still plenty of things going the wrong way. But it does feel like in 2020, that there's like, on some things, there's like new consensus. We've figured out, because we all got thrown in the deep end, right? We've figured out some new ways of doing stuff that everybody kind of agrees on. Do you think that's an accurate assessment? Do you think people now have a clearer idea of what the future of enterprise computing looks like because of the year that we've had?
It certainly has clarified certain things, like that zero trust is not just a good idea. It's truly a design pattern. It's not just a buzzword. You can actually build real deployments around those principles and evaluate your tooling around it. And we've seen that now where people who were saying like, hey, it's just an RSA buzzword, you know, that's jumped the shark, to saying, no, I get it now. I have all these people that I need to be able to enable to do work in multiple different ways. Where do I put my controls in? And that's going to be in the eye opener for that.
Now, you did a survey recently on the current state of Zero Trust. What did it find? I haven't had a chance to read it, unfortunately, but you know, it's great. I get to ask you about it the lazy way.
For sure. I mean, the whole idea of that survey was to try to understand what the real deployments look like and how mature are we. And we did one in 2019 and we did one in 2020. So we had some like longitudinal data to look at that. And one of the most interesting things that jumped out was simply this, that if you look at kind of like the contextual access and what do you actually use as a key indicator of you know, what matters for you for the context that you're, you know, collecting. Because if you think about zero trust, it's all about the context, saying give the right people the right level of access at the right time in the right context to the right resources and evaluate it, remove friction from the equation. That's it. The context of device has shifted, and now people are much more interested in 2020 in the zero trust you know, build outs to say, I need to understand the context of the devices that people are using and those who are basically, whether the device is known, whether it's managed or not, whether it's verified healthy, whether it has proper security in place.
Well, hang on. I just want to cut in there because, I mean, that's been one of the interesting things this year, right? Which is like previously the orthodoxy was never let a user access corporate resources from an unmanaged device. 2020 comes along and guess what? You have to do that, right? Like you don't have a choice anymore. And you'd say, okay, we can go out and buy all of our users' Chromebooks. No, you can't because everybody else had that idea. You know, the shelves at Best Buy got stripped.
Out.
Exactly, right? So it was just 2020 was one of those things where like you kind of had to embrace some of these zero trust principles that previously there'd been resistance on them. It's just amazing. Sorry, continue.
Oh, yeah, no, and that's absolutely right. And then the implication here was interesting because when we did our study, this was actually most of the data comes from truly pre-COVID times in like February, March, when this survey went out and before people were really forced into this model, January,
that's
February.
Yeah.
And we already saw that people had done the jump where 2019, whether device is known to me or not was a factor in less than about a third of the cases. And it jumped to about 60% where people said, hey, I want to understand if I've seen this device before. So it's the gradation. It used to be managed or not, binary, yes or no. Mm. Now it's like just one element of it. And you could say it's the device known is the first layer. Have I seen this device before? Second one is, am I managing it or not? Third one is it, what is its endpoint state? Is it on the latest patch level? Does it have endpoint, you know, security running on it? And can I get signal from that endpoint security to attest that it's actually healthy? Those all jump to the about two-thirds. Two-thirds of the respondents were saying that's a key element for their approach now. And the big shift was in the network context. Am I on a corporate recognized network zone or not? That dropped from about 55% to less than 20%.
Good.
So the importance of the network context of being the binary decider really fell away. And now the results of our survey look more like what the prescription of zero trust model, you know, hypothetically would look like, in that people are taking more richer context and the network is no longer the root and source of all trust.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? You know, and it's interesting that you say that that data comes from before the pandemic really kicked in, because I imagine if you did it now, like those trends just would have been reinforced so seriously by what's happened since, you know, January, February. It's interesting too, what you talk about attestation of like some sort of way to attest to the state of the security of an endpoint. This is some work that Duo obviously is a partner of Okta. They had some tricks just, you know, really looking at, you know, browser agent strings and stuff to get some idea of patch levels on, you know, on a particular device. I'd imagine you're doing much of the same thing, but this is where it gets hard, right? Because all of you fancy cloud web-based IDPs, you know, the whole point is they're agentless. And all of a sudden, you've got your end users who are starting to give a shit about the state of a device, and you can only infer so much from a browser agent string. So how do you start tackling that problem?
It is interesting. You can only do so much from the browser. And, you know, at the same time, the browsers are getting better at letting you know less about them, right?
Yes.
So, you know, and if you look at like Safari 14 and the massive, you know, firestorm that it, you know, lit up at the, you know, halls of Facebook and Instagram.
Because they're basically saying like, no more agent strings at all, right? Like
yeah,
just our mystery
business browser. Is going away, right?
Yeah.
For us, it's not quite as dire from that perspective, but what we're doing is actually going back to that model. I'm not calling it an agent. It ain't an agent. But if you think about like how most people are authenticating today, if they're using Okta, the majority of our customers are deploying things like the Okta Verify, which is basically a push app that allows you to, say, hey, it is me that is authenticating. Since it's running natively on the devices, like all the Android and iOS devices, we're using that as one element of saying, hey, that's a little bit of a footprint on the device that is opted in by the user themselves. And we're doing the same thing on now Windows and Mac. We call it FastPass, which is basically Okta Verify, but not as a push experience on those devices, but as simply as a footprint that allows us to get a signature of that device.
So, so basically what you're telling me is the solution to how do you do this without an agent is to roll an agent.
It's for an agent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not calling it an agent. Yeah, right. Yeah,
but see, exactly. Okay, so this is...
That's true. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
I'm doing some work with some people who do endpoint stuff, right? And one of the problems that I see that we're getting into, right, with a lot of the changes that we've had in 2020, I really want to get your opinion on this, is... You know, as I said, we're kind of moving away from a GPO world, right? And there's some really good endpoint workload, you know, tools coming out, endpoint policy tools. There's some interesting new approaches to endpoint security coming out. There's some interesting new approaches to like, you know, as you just said, roll an agent out. It feels like agent counts, desktop agent counts are coming back up again. And this is not where we want it to be, right? Like, is this something you're seeing as well? Because I mean, we've seen the research, right? Once you install like more than two or three agents on Windows, they basically stop working. You know, do you see desktop agent counts creeping up again?
Anecdotally, yes. I haven't got the survey data to back that up, but talking to our customers, we certainly see that. What is actually countering that trend maybe somewhat is that if you have tooling that's running on those devices, then if you can absorb the signal from that tooling and act on it, you don't need your own agent there if you can trust that signal. The other thing that we're seeing is that their environment of those endpoints is becoming more heterogeneous than not. There's even less standardization because more and more organizations are virtual. They have more and more contingent and temporary workers and contract workers where you don't issue and manage their environments. And it's more and more difficult to enforce your endpoint, tooling on them. So what we're seeing is an ask from our customers to say, give me a way of course, absorbing the signal from my MDM framework, if I have such, and other endpoint resource management frameworks, but also be able to consume signal from the endpoint security vendors directly. Say, if you have Tanium CrowdStrike
or whatever,
device.
Yeah. No, I mean, I see that as well, but then it doesn't get us around that problem of like unmanaged endpoints, you know, like this, it's still, this is the missing piece, I think, from Zero Trust, is what you need is a lightweight Swiss Army agent that can do those policy functions. It can do execution and application control. It can do some lightweight monitoring and logging. I mean, it just boggles my mind that it's still not very good endpoint security software. It's just not. It's overweight. It misses shit. It's trivially bypassable. And it's simultaneously like the single biggest market in the industry. Why is it so shit still, Sammy? I don't get it.
I'm glad that I don't work for an endpoint vendor, you know, here. But all I can say is, luckily, my microphone is hopefully pretty good, and you don't hear my fans on my computer going like crazy, and probably because of all the endpoint agents that my company is running on my endpoint. So I literally feel your pain, and I'm feeling the heat, because the heat is emanating from those fans into my lap right now. But yeah, it is not great. I lived next door at one point to a CEO of an endpoint security company, because I live in the Bay Area, so you can probably throw a rock and hit one of those guys right now. But you know, we had that conversation over some barbecue, and he was saying that, you know, he runs the company and he doesn't have high hopes for the endpoints, but it is what we have. And you could argue that this should be the job of the platform vendors, that if Windows provided better tooling, if iOS, Android, macOS provided better interfaces, they wouldn't have to do the unnatural acts that they do today.
Well, I think Apple has actually made some meaningful progress there with its, you know, with its endpoint security API. And, you know, Trail of Bits has written a reference implementation for that that, you know, sounds pretty good. I mean, I haven't looked at it myself and I'm not really qualified to make an assessment. But given that it is an implementation, a reference implementation designed to interact with an API that runs in userland that's designed specifically for that purpose, you know, you would think that that's going to be the way to go. But it just sort of surprises me that given the rivers of gold that flow into the coffers of endpoint companies, you know, you just think they'd do a better job. That's all.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that. But, you know, again, I feel like, you know, the blame is also largely on the fact that the operating systems that we're saddled with, you know, haven't been great for that. But they are definitely getting better. And if you look at like the current, think about like what happened with Windows over the last 10 years. It went from being just a joke in InfoSec circles to being truly a credible player in the participation of everybody's, you know, rescue here. And same thing, it's true with macOS. It went from no security at all to actually being a really nicely architected, you know, environment. iOS is you know, blazing the trail for privacy and security in many ways. So I think we're moving to the right direction. And I think that you need the tooling that can take advantage of the signal that you have, not the signal that you wish you had, but use the signal that you have, integrate it into a better decision, and then everybody's better off.
But what do you do, right, when you've got users all of a sudden coming in from unmanaged devices? Like, what, are you going to send them a guide on how to install CrowdStrike and enroll it correctly? I mean,
No. You can't even ask them that if they are, you know, say, customers of yours. Nobody's going to do that, right?
Yeah.
And it's the continuum of users. It's not just, you know, employee, non-employee. It is like you have different grades of an employee from, you know, true, you know, high risk individuals who have access to modify your CI/CD pipeline, or, you know, CFO who has, you know, purse strings, or, and then employees of various kinds. But the problem is, no matter who your employees, they're all potential vectors that you can pivot off of. And if you compromise their account, you can pivot off to the next one. So my point is, you just need to put in as much security as is reasonable with least amount of friction and put in front of everybody. And that's where I feel like companies like we can actually make a meaningful difference. Because if every application you access is behind an IDP, you have a single control point where you can deploy your web authent. And now you have a relatively unfishable solution in place, and you can move to passwordless identity and authentication for the vast majority of their users, really remove friction. And I think that that's the unsung, you know, like, you know, little site journey here, which is, if you're not making it easier and better every day for the end user in whatever you're deploying as a security professional, it's not helping. Because if it's not making the end user's lives noticeably better, the thing that you just did, they're not going to do it, but instead they're going to just sign up yet another rogue account. You know, people talk about rogue IT. I don't think it's the right term. It's citizen IT. Citizens helping themselves because the IT didn't do their job and make their lives easier. So if we can turn those, you know, roadblocks 90 degrees into guardrails and just keep people from hurting themselves, that's the ultimate goal that we should all have.
All right, Sammy Lane, thank you so much for joining us on the Risky Biz Soapbox to talk all things, you know, Okta, Zero Trust, and to indulge me in my rant about the poor quality of endpoint security software. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you.
Patrick, it was really a pleasure of mine.
That was Sammy Lane there, Director of Technology Strategy at Okta. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Okta for being a sponsor of the Risky Business Podcast. And that is it from me today. I'll be publishing another special edition of the show next week, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.